I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. John Carlin served as the 40th governor of Kansas, but if you ask him, he'll say his greatest achievement was his work as the archivist of the United States after being appointed by Bill Clinton in 1995. Today, he's still heavily involved in public issues, both state and national, and will get his perspective on the coming elections, including the contentious race for his former office. Then we shift focus to the end of the Second World War with the enthralling maritime drama of the doomed USS Indianapolis. One of thousands of ships lost in the war, the battle over her ending would last for 50 years. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The last Democrat to serve two full terms as Kansas governor? If you said Kathleen Sebelius, you're wrong. She didn't quite complete her second term. Joan Finney didn't run for a second term. No, you have to go all the way back to John Carlin from 1979 to 1987. Besides serving as a two-term governor here, Carlin would go on to serve as archivist of the United States for a decade. Today, he's a visiting professor, executive in residence in the political science department at Kansas State University. He's active in this year's race for Kansas governor, backing Democrat Josh Swatty. Governor Carlin, welcome. So nice to have you here today.
Good morning, Steve. I appreciate the opportunity.
Governor Carlin joins us from the campus of, you're in Topeka this morning, right?
I'm in Topeka. Yeah. I didn't feel I had the time for today to go all the way to Kansas City, and somebody was kind enough to set it up to have it here in Topeka, but basically, we're talking to each other, and I've known you for a long time.
Yes, you have. Well, Governor, we're too close to the primary election here to allow you to do much electioneering, but why did you decide to engage in this year's race for governor?
I did because of the great significance of the race. We're going to decide which direction as a state we want to go. 2016, just for legislative races, the people of Kansas elected a very different legislature. Much more open to addressing the real challenges we face, turning some of the mistakes the Brownback administration made, turning them around. And now, having done that, having increased support for education, for an example, the state will decide in this election year for governor as to whether they want to continue to go forward, be progressive, to take on the challenges we face and make Kansas more attractive for doing business.
Right.
We've got to grow. And so I felt like, I couldn't stay on the sidelines. Just too important a race.
You know, Kansas is a red state. You know, no one denies that. But the state also has this remarkable history of going from a Democratic governor to a Republican governor and then back to a Democratic governor. This pattern dates back to the 1970s. I assume you think a Democrat can win it back this year, but I'm wondering why. I mean, there's an independent in the race, Greg Orman, and a lot of observers say he'll take enough votes away from the Democrat to allow the Republican contender to win in November. What do you say to that?
Well, we don't have a lot of experience with an independent candidate that's got the resources to really compete. So, it's all hypothetical, guessing, whatever. It would be really unfortunate if all our independent candidate does is keep a progressive, sane, very skilled Democrat from winning. Mm-hmm. And I had hoped he would be more realistic. I don't see any path for him winning, and I don't see losing doing his career any good in terms of future political opportunities. But apparently he's going to actually file. Hasn't yet. That's one unique thing about an independent. Mm-hmm. You turn in signatures, and I think the deadline is August the 1st to turn him in, and then from there on, you're an official candidate going forward.
You know, Governor, why were you able to win the office way back in 1979? Because, no offense, Governor, that was the year I graduated from college.
Well, I, You know, my theory for a long time, and quite frankly, built on my own experience, is that Democrats depend heavily on the Republicans screwing up. We've never really taken out a real strong Republican. But the Republicans have had trouble for a while nominating someone who had the capacity to really do well. Factually, I won because I could not raise money. And so
what do you mean you couldn't raise money?
Well, incumbent Governor Bob Bennett, very skilled, very talented. We had differences, and that's why I was running. But he was backed by all the special interests, just everybody assuming he was going to win, including his own campaign. And, you know, the Topeka Daily Capital had a front page article on Sunday before the Tuesday election that Bennett was up 49-33.
Wow.
That was a poll based during the previous week. What they didn't know or dig enough to find out was I wasn't on television until that last week. And any incumbent that can't get over 49, there's a problem.
Mm.
And so they were, you know, a lot of people were waiting to see who is his opponent. And apparently I looked good enough that last week. I could tell it. I was in Wichita campaign the last weekend. And for the first time, I could walk into a bowling alley and people would turn around and they'd recognize who I was. I could feel the energy taking place.
Right.
I knew that it was going to be a long shot. But I did something in 1978 that Democrats have struggled to remember and take advantage of, and that is the importance of campaigning statewide. I really worked the entire state. The year before, I was heavily out in rural areas and went back right after the primary in August to retrace all those tracks and get back in those communities, and that's why I won.
Huh.
Now, I wasn't carrying very many of those counties, but I wasn't getting clobbered. Paul Davis got clobbered. He didn't work those counties. And it just does not work.
Paul Davis, the candidate for governor in 2016, right? Yeah.
2014.
2014, right.
Yeah, I mean, a great candidate, but followed a strategy that I... And the other thing, Steve, I would say in terms of talking about politics and how things have changed, there's a real connection between what statewide candidates do and what happens with legislative races. When I was in the legislature and when I was governor, we had Democrats, legislative Democrats, from all over the state. Now, obviously, we didn't have a huge number in rural areas, but we were there, and we were represented. And I personally believe it's tied to statewide candidates being out there, making people feel like they're important, which generates an organization which helps everybody, including legislative candidates. And we've kind of gotten away from that. And I think, you know, this primary is going to be a test of that in terms of whether it's still important to work the entire
right.
state. I don't like, as a Democrat and a former Speaker of the House, that, you know, we've had years where we didn't have any west of 81 highway.
Right.
Well, that's, you know.
Former Kansas Governor John Carlin is my guest. You know, there's a lot of angst these days, Governor, about whether the Democratic Party is large enough to include those who oppose abortion rights or those who have won endorsements from the NRA. How do you see it?
Well, and my comment here is not just state, but nationally. I think when you go too far with a litmus test, it's going to not help you politically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we talk about, as Democrats, well, we've got to do this. We got to elect more United States senators, take over the House, etc. But if you narrow it down to a strict set of commitments, there are many states, many areas, many times when you got to be a little more flexible to go in with a candidate that may not meet all your checks, but can win.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look at what happened in, where was it, Alabama, I believe. They allowed and supported and got behind a candidate that wasn't pure from the standpoint of some, but he was a good man, basically supportive of important issues that would make a real difference in the lives of people.
This is Doug Jones in the U.S. Senate
yes,
now.
Yes, Doug Jones.
Mm-hmm.
And
State is so Republican, Governor, what can a Democrat bring to the conversation that can benefit Kansas these days? Because these days, as you know, Republicans badly outnumber Democrats, and so do independent voters, for that matter.
Well, you know, the key, there are a lot of independents, for an example, that philosophically go with the Democrats. They just don't like to be associated with an official party. The other thing you have to keep in mind, there are huge numbers of Republicans that are Republicans only because they live in a county that the Republicans are the only ones that have local primaries. You can go to a rural county and find Democrats, but they're registered Republican because they want to have input on who the county sheriff is going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes back to the fact we've allowed Republicans to just dominate too many counties. But they're there. And they can be energized. I can feel it this year in terms of the contacts I've made and talking to people that there are real concerns about continuing the current direction all across the state.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a very viable year for a Democrat.
You know,
because there's so much concern about some of the issues coming nationally, the Brownback legacy is still going forward. Nobody that is given a serious chance of winning on the Republican side for governor wants to change that. Hmm. They want to go back and be a part of that. They actually believe less government is better. Now, the appropriate level is important.
Hmm.
You don't throw money away. But, Steve, one thing I tell people on taxes and resources coming from the farm, if a farmer decided the most important thing on fertilizer was to save money and cut back, that would be a very costly mistake.
Mm-hmm.
The crops would not be good. He would still be paying for a lot of fertilizer. Likewise, putting too much on doesn't work. It's finding the right level so you're funding and getting the quality education. You're taking care of the roads. You're taking care of people. I mean, one thing, Steve, about this campaign that's just been shocking to me because, I was talking to a Democrat in Pawnee County, Larned, and they have the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Because of what's gone on in funding, they have people doing 16-hour shifts.
Wow.
To take a very small staff and stretch it far enough, because obviously it's got to have 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, service, responsibility.
Yeah.
And that's too much the case. I mean, we had the prison situation, I think temporarily corrected, but where they were working 12-hour shifts just simply because of a lack of money.
Yeah.
And so the fact that all the top Republicans are talking the hard right, extreme right, that's just not satisfactory for the state of Kansas going forward.
Again, former Kansas Governor John Carlin is my guest. And welcome back to the second half of Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, Powell Gardens may be getting 7,000 new neighbors, and they think that stinks, literally. On yesterday's program, we talked about the planned expansion of a cattle feed operation a few miles from the Botanical Garden. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, how right-to-work legislation impacts black workers, and one of the reasons why the local chapter of the NAACP is hoping to get people to the polls in August. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. On July 30th, 1945, the USS Indianapolis was crossing the Philippine Sea. The heavy cruiser was the flagship of the 5th Fleet and had just completed a record-breaking run across the Pacific on a top-secret mission, delivery of the plutonium that would be used in the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. Now on her way back for refresher training, the Indianapolis was following her assigned course across the sea and straight into the path of a submarine of the Imperial Japanese Navy. What happened next and into the days and years that followed is the subject of a new book, Indianapolis, the true story of the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history and the 50-year fight to exonerate an innocent man. National Geographic historian Sarah Vlaidic is co-author of this account and joins us now by Skype from San Diego. Sarah, it's nice to have you. Good morning. Why is this disaster surrounding the USS Indianapolis, why is it the worst sea disaster in U.S. naval history?
It is the greatest loss of life at sea during wartime. And so 1,200 men, well, nearly 1,200, 11,000, or I am sorry, 1,195 men went into the water and 316 survived.
The construction of this class of ship had two design elements that contributed to its sinking. What were they?
Well, the ship was built for speed. It did not have the extra layer on the hull in order to protect it from torpedoes and attack. I mean, it was meant to get to the action and use their big guns. And so, you know, then the second thing was that they didn't have sonar on the ship, and so they couldn't detect this. They were always meant to have an escort. And in this case, there was no reported action at the area they were traveling, and so they were told they didn't need an escort.
How many men were on board the Indianapolis altogether?
Altogether, there was 1,195. There was one gentleman who was a passenger, so there were 1,194 crewmen.
There was a controversy around that one person for a while, right?
Well, what it was that there was a young man by the name of Clarence Donner who was on the ship, and he actually was reassigned 30 minutes before she left port. And so in those times, the records were turned in at the end of the month, and so when the ship sank, all the records were lost, and so the Navy had believed he was aboard that ship and had gone down with it. And so it wasn't until this year that we actually fixed that and found out that he was not aboard and that there were 316 survivors.
It was determined of these men, the 300 who went down with the ship, that left a lot of men floating in the water. What did they have to keep them afloat that day?
The majority of the men in the water only had life jackets. Some didn't have anything at all. There were a few floater nets, and there were about 12 rafts. However, the very small group of men made it on the rafts because they went on the starboard side of the ship, or they went off the ship on the starboard side, which was where all the supplies went, but that was the smallest group of men. So there were over 300 to 400 men in the water with nothing but life jacket or just the flotsam in the water that they could hold on to for the 5 days.
How effective were those life jackets?
They really turned out to be quite ineffective, actually. They were made to be used for no more than 72 hours. And so they started to actually pull the men down. And, you know, if you put your hands in water, or you put any part of your body in water for an extended period of time, you know how it gets all wrinkly and hard to use. Well, these men couldn't untie the life jackets. And so they started drowning them. And even so much so when the rescuers pulled some of the men out of the water and they'd cut off the life jackets, they'd sink like a rock. So these were not helping them stay alive in the water.
You know, one thing that struck me was their voyage across the Philippine Sea was similar to air traffic control today. I mean, responsibility for the ship passed from one naval control point to another. What information was known about the Indianapolis's route and its expected travel time?
There was quite a lot of information was sent out to various parties, but this was really a scenario where it was a perfect storm, a perfect disaster, really, where some of the messages were garbled. So the people who were, you know, should have been expecting them weren't because they didn't know they were coming. And the ones who sent them didn't know that those individuals didn't receive it. And then also at this time in the war, you know, non-arrivals were not ordered to be reported. So it could be a case where a ship of this importance was redirected and for the sake of secrecy, no one would, you know, they wouldn't report that over communication so people would know, the enemy would find out. So really, you know, the people in the ports who were expecting the ship thought, oh, okay, it was just rerouted where it, you know, it sank and nobody knew.
That's the problem. Nobody knew what happened to this ship. These men are in the water and nobody's looking for them, right?
Exactly. They went unmissed for 5 days, or I'm sorry, 5 nights and 4 days.
If it had been reported, how soon could the survivors have expected rescue after the ship went down?
Within 12 hours.
Oh my gosh.
And that is from the nearest land. They were about 280 miles from the closest land.
But instead, they're in the water for 5 days and four nights, you said, right?
Yes, 5 nights and 4 days.
Five nights and four days.
They sunk just after midnight.
How did they wind up being rescued?
It was absolutely providential. You know, a young pilot by the name of Wilbur Gwynn was flying patrol, and he was testing out a new antenna, and it broke off. And so he'd gone back to the plane to check it. He looked down. He spotted an oil slick. And he thought that was an enemy submarine because that was a telltale sign of enemy, or, well, just submarines in general. And so he opened the bomb bay doors, was about to, you know, drop attack, and he sees heads in the water. And he doesn't know at this point if they're American, if they're Japanese. He doesn't know what this is because there's been nothing reported as having been sunk in, you know, recent days. So he flies closer. He calls into the radio, ducks on the pond. You know, it's about 150 he's spotting at this time. And they're spread out over at least 25 miles by this point. So the area he saw, there was about 100 so survivors in the water. He calls it in. And then it, from that point, it took 12 hours for the ships to arrive and start pulling men out of the water.
After 5 nights and 4 days in the water, how many men were left, Sarah?
There were 320 men who were pulled from the water, and four, unfortunately, passed away before they, you know, before the rescue had completed. So 316 were counted as survivors.
You know, sharks took their share of the crew. I can hardly imagine anything more terrifying. What did the men tell you about the terror they experienced of those shark attacks?
There were hundreds of sharks that reported in the area, and the men, the uncertainty of it was the biggest fear factor for them because they didn't know when they would attack and who they would attack. They were indiscriminate. And so these men lost their best friends. You know, these are guys they've served with for years, right next to them, and to be pulled from the water right next to your best friend, you know. It was very traumatic for them, obviously. And, you know, not just the shark attacks they were faced with, you know, these men not having food or water for 5 days, they're starting to hallucinate. They're starting to turn on each other. You have to remember, too, they're covered in thick tar-like oil, and so they can't identify people, you know, unless they're actually close enough to talk to them. So when they start hallucinating, they think the men next to them are Japanese enemies trying to attack them, and it gets very violent in that way, too. So they weren't just afraid of the sharks. It was, you know, there became a point where they were afraid of each other, too.
Gosh. Tell us about the oil, a little more about the oil, and just the damage the oil did to these men as they were trying to survive this thing.
Well, when they went into the water, the surface of the water was covered in this oil that had been released by the engineering department. And this is thick, thick oil that can't be removed unless it's heated. So like I had mentioned, it's like a tar. And, you know, it's getting in their lungs, it's getting in their stomachs, it's causing them to vomit, which causes dehydration. And, you know, it's really kind of the first domino in a set of problems that led to many men succumbing to this. And so, you know, the one benefit that it did provide is the unrelentless sun that would, you know, be on them 12 hours a day. And so it did provide some protection from that. But a lot of it was very hard on their eyes. It caused eye infections. It caused ulcers. And, you know, with that comes more sharks or more sea life.
Sarah Vladek is my guest. She's the co-author of a new book, Indianapolis, The True Story of the Worst Sea Disaster in U.S. Naval History and the 50-Year Fight to Exonerate an Innocent Man. Let's talk about that innocent man for a moment. Among the survivors was the ship's captain, Charles McVeigh III. There's a point in the book where you write that he knew almost immediately that the Navy was going to look for someone to hang this disaster on and that it would be him. Why would the Navy do that after it had screwed up so badly in, you know, at first not even reporting the ship missing?
Well, as being the commander of this vessel, you are ultimately responsible for the vessel. And so the easy answer to a problem when you have 879 families looking for someone to blame is the captain. And so he held that weight on his shoulders for a very long time. And that was something he expected. And then in addition to that, you know, what some of the things that we found for the very first time ever in researching for this book was how much the higher level admirals and such were actually responsible and were never held to be responsible for it. It was blamed solely on the captain. And so in an effort, you know, the war had just ended, you know, people are being celebrated, these Nimitz and King and Naquin, all of these high-ranking military men would be the ones that the fingers would be pointed at, and they couldn't let that happen. And so McVeigh knew that he would be the one that would take the blame.
What was he blamed for? What was the mistake he made, at least in the eyes of some of the families who lost loved ones here?
Well, interestingly enough, the Navy, when they had started to begin the court of inquiry and then the court-martial, blamed him. They had a list of items that they were trying to go after him for, and one by one were checking off that it was not possible to charge him with. And at this point, the only thing they came up with was negligence because he failed to zigzag. And at the time, you know, the Japanese, they had already taken into account that strategy for warships. They were very familiar with it. It was something they factored in to their attacks. And so when the Japanese commander was called into the court-martial to testify, and this was the first time an enemy was called in to testify against one of our own, where he said, no matter what, I would have sunk the ship. And they still court-martialed McVeigh for this, because there was nothing else they could get him on. And because of that, and because of the way he was painted for the public, the families latched onto that. And so it was more the Navy saying, he's the one responsible, blame him, that he took that burden on. And the survivors, the crew, they felt very differently. And that's why they took this up, this fight up for 50 years to clear their captain.
What did the crew think of Charles McVeigh III? What kind of leader was he, Sarah?
He was a fantastic leader. They all speak very, very highly of him. He was the kind of captain that when the young enlisted men would complain about food, he would go eat in the mess hall and tell the cooks that they better step it up a notch. You know, all his men deserved a good meal. He was the kind of captain that, you know, if the officers got to watch a movie, so did the enlisted men. So he really took care of his men. And he was from a long line of Navy, you know, family. And so he was headed for the top. He was a great officer, well-decorated, had prestigious roles. He was heading for an admiral.
But he would never hold a command again, would he?
He would not. His rank was reduced, and he would serve in offices for the remainder of his career.
You know, there were families of those who didn't survive that continued to send hate mail to McVeigh for the remainder of his life, blaming him for the death of their loved ones. What was the toll on him as those years unwound?
As you can imagine, the burden that he carried for that and those reminders every Christmas when he would get a letter that said, you know, our son is not here to celebrate Christmas with us because of you. Those added up, and there were a lot of other circumstances surrounding it, but ultimately in 1968, he did take his own life.
You know, in commenting on McVeigh's death, you guys write this: McVeigh was not the only Indianapolis survivor to end his own life. At least a dozen more committed suicide within a few years after the sinking. In a sense, the telegram the families received announcing that Indy had sunk with 100% casualties was true. Even among the survivors, no man who went into the water was the same man who came out. Boy, that just grips you, Sarah.
It's just these men, for the rest of their lives, would obviously be impacted by this. And the things they saw and the experience that they went through in that water to survive is unimaginable for anyone, you know. And I think they started having reunions in 1960. And when they got together and they started talking about it, that was the first time they were able to heal. And really, because no one on earth could understand what that was like until, you know, except each other.
You know, I've just got to ask you, we just have a couple of minutes left here, why you became so interested in this story, because it really goes back through so much of your own life.
It does. I heard about it when I was 13 years old, and it was reduced to one line. It was the ship that carried the atomic bomb and was sunk. And I thought, that can't be real. How do I not know? And, you know, this was before Google and all these things. So I actually went to the library and looked it up and couldn't find a whole lot. And I thought, how can something so important be something that nobody knows? We didn't learn about this in school. It was just never talked about. And so when I graduated from college, I reached out to the survivors and they took me in, and it was just them charging me with their story and to be their storyteller. And from there, that responsibility is, I mean, the greatest honor, you know, to be asked that. And so I wanted to honor them in the way they deserved, and it really evolved from there. So 17 years later, here we are.
And when you would get discouraged with the enormity of the task in front of you of telling this story, time and time again, the survivors sort of came to your rescue, didn't they?
They did. I mean, as soon as I wanted to give up, and it was really serendipitous, if you will, that and providential, that I wanted to give up, and I'd get a call that day from one of them asking how I was doing and if it was coming along. And, you know, the thing they taught me very early on was you never give up. And if they could never give up for what they fought through, I certainly could keep trucking along on the story. So I believe they owed that. They were owed that.
Sarah Vladeck has been my guest. Her new book, Indianapolis, The True Story of the Worst Sea Disaster in U.S. Naval History and a 50-Year Fight to Exonerate an Innocent Man. It's a gripping story. Sarah, thanks so much for taking some time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was nice being on.